Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
Let's talk about lactic acid. New and really exciting scientific information here about lactic acid as a signal, an epigenetic modifier. And not only that, but a new kind of epigenetic modification that, and this being an area of great interest of mine, I have to tell you, this really is new. I have not heard this described before. So let's talk physiology for just a second. All cells need energy to keep on living. But mammalian cells, most of our body cells, are very, very efficient. They're like a very high mileage vehicle. They get a lot of molecules of energy in the form of ATP out of just one molecule of glucose. Cancer cells have an increased demand of energy. They need it now. They are high performance vehicles and they don't get good mileage on their glucose. They use a process called glycolysis, which generates, it's like the difference between a car that gets 60 miles to the gallon and a car that gets 15 miles to the gallon. It's that kind of level of variation. Pretty substantial. Probably what gave us an evolutionary edge, because those bacteria, they're pretty smart. In today's issue of Nature, researchers have shown, and this is researchers at the University of Chicago, they've shown that what we call the Warburg effect, and I'll come back to that in a minute, but basically glycolysis produces lactic acid as a byproduct. Anybody who's ever had sore muscles, somebody's probably told you, oh, that's lactic acid in your muscles. I'm not so sure that's true, but that's another conversation. Lactate, however, is not just a waste product. It turns out to be a regulatory product, and it affects many cell types like immune cells and stem cells. Two researchers at Chicago have been looking into this Warburg effect, which is basically just the fact that cancer cells prefer to use glycolysis and they generate lactic acid. Warburg, by the way, won the Nobel Prize in 1931 for this discovery, so it was considered a pretty big deal at the time. Lactate is generated by cancer cells. Lactate is the source and stimulator of a new type of histone modification, a type of epigenetic change that they have named histone lactylation. So what histones are, these little spools, like spools of thread, and the DNA is wound around them. So how it's wound and whether it's wound tightly determines whether DNA is going to be transcribed and turned into enzymes or other structural proteins. Macrophages are one of the key cells in our immune system. They're giant Pac-Man type amoebas, and they just eat anything that looks like a bacteria. There are two states that you can find a macrophage in. And typically when there's a bacterial infection, you have a pro-inflammatory antibacterial state that they call M1. And during the early phases of an infection, the bacteria are generating lactic acid. The macrophage gets in there. It's stimulated by the lactic acid to actually flip its metabolism so that it can rapidly generate cytokines, which are chemical messenger signals that go out. And it's like calling all cars. All of the other immune cells are attracted to the cytokines and converge on the site of infection. Over time, the cytokines turn themselves down. And this partially happens because the lactate that's being generated by the bacteria and by the macrophage actually cause it to acetylate its histones, lactate its histones. And this causes the genes that are being expressed to shift to a more stabilizing genes that are like, okay, now that we've had the firestorm and we've used the flamethrower to clean up the infection, now we're going to bring in the fibroblasts and the healing cells and move to clean up and restore mode. And this is a classic self-regulatory loop. We see these everywhere in biology. And it accounts for some of the stuff that we know, like, for example, the old, what does not destroy you makes you stronger. When you break down, when you exercise and you break down muscle tissue or you stress muscle tissue, it causes local hypoxia. It causes the production of chemicals that cause you to make more mitochondria in your muscle cells. So that the next time you are presented with that level of load, you'll have the ability to deal with it. Reparative M2 macrophage is great when you're in a bacterial situation. But the problem is cancer cells make a lot of lactate, leads to a triggering of this event. The macrophages then lactate their histones, and now they are promoting growth. They're providing growth factors. They may even be facilitating metastasis. And one of the things we see as a phenomenon is that the immune system in cancer comes to tolerate and even promote the cancer. This is called a permissive environment. And a lot of the things that we do in functional and natural medicine in the realm of cancer are all about shifting the environment through, for example, a low glucose diet so that there isn't enough glucose around for the cancer cells to do glycolysis. We also do things like giving plant products that shift the environment and turn off some of these effects. So the researchers here didn't get into that aspect of things, but because I'm a natural medicine doctor as well as a board certified family physician, I wanted to bring that in. It's possible that other T cells, other immune cells are also regulated by this mechanism, and this may explain why in cancer we see a tolerance develop to the cancers. Lots of different mechanisms for that, including the cancers mutating themselves. But the point is, this is extremely cool science, and I'm very, very excited about it. The next thing I want to talk about is also on this same topic, and that's cancer. There's a synthetic compound. It's an extract of turmeric, and it's a synthetic version. It kills cancer cells without adverse effects on normal cells. We know this. And it works by suppressing an enzymatic activity. This product is called PGV1, and there is a ton of anti-cancer research going on it right now. But I want to point out to you, this is essentially a weaponized version of a molecule that's found in turmeric. And if you eat a lot of turmeric, maybe that's why we see in people who have that diet an improvement in their risk of cancer, in their rates of developing cancers. The mechanism here is related to reactive oxygen species. These are things that are generated through energy production. You make a lot of reactive oxidative species, for example, in generating that energy I was talking about. And many of you have probably heard of glutathione. Well, glutathione is super important in the energy production process because it is the ultimate sink where all those free radicals go. And the quote-unquote antioxidants like vitamin C and vitamin E, those are also free radical absorbers. Like a wet sponge, they take care of the sparks. This PGV1 compound stops cells in the M phase. It stops them from dividing, and it prevents them from protecting themselves. And it's been shown to be a terribly good cancer drug in experimental models. They also did a study where they injected human cancers into mice and gave them this drug, and the cancers didn't take. They couldn't root in the mice. And this is not what happened in the control animals who got the cancer just as expected. So we aren't sure exactly how much this can be developed as a pharmaceutical cancer agent. While we're waiting for those studies, let me just give you some advice. Let's do some turmeric as a cancer preventative. If you don't want to take turmeric, take 500 milligrams of curcumin, but do it every day. Later on, I'll give it out right now. And that thing I'm going to give out right now is free good medical advice. And my good medical advice is take some turmeric, just the raw, fresh stuff, and mix in about 10% black pepper and either throw it into a soup or throw it into a capsule, and you need about a teaspoon a day to get the anti-cancer effect. So that is the poor man's expensive pharmaceutical. This email from Roseanne, who doesn't tell us where she's from, but it looks like she's local. She says, Dr. Don, local dermatologist is telling his patients to take vitamin B3 based on info from the Skin Cancer Foundation that says it significantly decreases the incidence of non-melanoma skin cancers. Dosage 500 milligrams twice a day. He is also taking it. Comments, please. Also, is this much safe for the liver? So I'm going to start, Roseanne, with your last question. Yeah, this is not vitamin B3, actually. The research is on nicotinamide, which is a closely related molecule. Vitamin B3 is technically niacin. So I want to clarify that. The research on this derivative is strong, as research goes. There are a few caveats, which I'll get to in a moment. But in terms of your toxic effects, this is really very well tolerated. Niacin, which is B3, causes flushing, and we use it to bring down triglycerides, which are blood fats, and it raises protective high-density lipoprotein. So all good, right, for the cardiovascular. But getting people on a therapeutic dose is tough because they flush and they get diarrhea. Nicotinamide is better. It's better tolerated. You can take grams of the stuff, and the dose here in the study was 500 milligrams twice a day, so a gram a day. You don't get into problems with the liver, and they did do toxicology studies, until you get up to about 9 grams, so almost tenfold the recommended dose for the benefit that was seen. And the benefit was in non-melanoma skin cancer. So you still need to stay out of the sun. This is not a magic shield against skin cancer. And the study was conducted in 2015 by Dr. Chen. It was a first phase 3 study, and it showed that in people who had high risk for skin cancer, I think this is really important, these were people who had at least 2 non-melanoma skin cancers in the previous 5 years, done in Australia, as you might expect. And there were 386 adults, and they either got placebo or they got this. So we have about 150 people. And at the end of a year, the incidence of new non-melanoma skin cancers was reduced by 23% in the treatment group. And so that was statistically significant at a 0.02. And just to remind you, 0.05 means 1 out of 20. So 0.02 is 1 out of 50. So if you did the same study 50 times, most of those, this one has basically a 40, it has a good chance of being correct. It would be 49 out of 50 of the times this study would actually work, is kind of the way to think of it, I guess. So there's a 1 out of 50 chance that it was just due to chance, is another way of thinking about it. We like to say that anything could just be through random chance. You could flip 10 heads in a row on a coin that wasn't loaded, but it's not going to happen most of the time. And so if you think of it as of what's going to happen most of the time this stuff's going to work. And the question is, well, what about long-term? Because those skin cancers were there already. They probably were not yet manifesting. But we know that the cancers develop in the body, and then gradually over time they grow. So what isn't established by the study is whether or not it just slows down the development of cancers, and in the long run, the number would be the same. And we saw that, for example, when women stopped taking estrogen after the big Women's Health Study Initiative crisis back in 2002. We saw everybody stop their estrogen. We saw a drop in new cancer cases for about a year, and then it went back to normal. So what we were seeing was case detection shift, but we weren't seeing that the estrogen was causing those cancers. It was a growth hormone. It was making them grow. This could be a similar thing. This could be a growth delayer. There was a secondary analysis that was done of the trial that suggested that this evidence was not sufficient and wasn't necessarily reproducible, so not as strong as I suggested before. So the jury, I would say, is still out on this in terms of how effective it really is over the long term. But in terms of toxicity, it's very low. You basically have to worry if you have kidney failure. It can cause your platelets to drop if you have kidney failure. Some people can get problem with diarrhea, but usually it's at much higher doses. Now I want to correct something. I said 9 grams for hepatotoxicity, but actually, apparently in this study they saw they thought or stated that it could occur at doses higher than 3 grams. So take the recommended dose. Don't assume more is better. Otherwise, I think it's pretty solid stuff. A second email, this from Eric in Scotts Valley. Eric writes, rebuttal to the study suggesting D3 and fish oil ineffective. Hi, Dr. Dawn. After hearing you mention this study on your show, I came across this, which if you haven't seen, may interest you. And what's interesting me actually, Eric, is I'm looking at the notes and I haven't marked this off as something I talked about, but let's talk about failure by design, because the rebuttal you sent me, which is not exactly from a disinterested source, it's Life Extension Magazine, and the Life Extension Company is basically in the business of selling supplements. I will say in their favor, they do tend to be science-based, and I often will follow their suggestions in terms of dosing, because I do think it's fairly well-researched. But they are a green pharmacy group. They are there to sell vitamins. And if you did everything they told you to do, you'd be taking like 50 pills a day. And I know some people who do, but I just don't see that as sustainable for the general public. So what's wrong with the Vital Study? Briefly, what the Vital Study did was a big trial, was they gave people vitamin D at 2,000 units a day, and they gave them marine fish oil fatty acids at a dose of 1 gram per day. And the first thing that I wrote here was failure by design on my notes, because that's too low a dose to do anything. What you want to do with vitamin D, if you're trying to prevent cancer, is you want to actually give enough to get the blood levels up above 50. And that is super, super important. If you don't get the blood levels where they need to be, you're not going to get a benefit. The doses that they used would not have gotten the right blood levels. I typically use 5,000 units of vitamin D. And by the way, I try to get all of my cancer survivors to take enough vitamin D to get their blood levels up above 50. And I usually shoot for 60, mid 40s to 60. I also shoot for even higher doses if we're talking about a person who has autoimmune disease. And then I'll try to get that vitamin D up to 70 to 80, because there is solid data showing that you get an improvement in cancer survival and cancer incidence over the long term when you do this. Now, this study was also not run very long, and that's another objection to it, because when they said that you didn't get a improvement in cancer mortality from vitamin D, you actually did, but it took more than 2 years to show up. So as a result, if you were just like I was saying before, if you've already got cancer, then expecting this to prevent cancer is kind of silly. So maybe what you need to do is figure how long would it take it to prevent cancer. Let's let 2 or 3 years go by, flush out all the cancers, and then look at new cancers occurring farther down the line. And with most nutritionals, that's what you have to do. You have to wait a long time for all of the cancers that are currently there to flush out before you can really say this prevented cancer. You can, however, show that the time to death was increased, or that the actual fact of death was shifted, and we do have data on vitamin D for that. That's pretty solid data. The other thing that they were looking at was the efficacy of fish oil. And I want to talk for a moment about the omega-3, omega-6 problem, and what really you should be going for cardiovascular disease and also for cancer prevention. So in the case of the omegas, we evolved to be eating a plant and animal diet. We did not evolve to be eating oils that were squeezed from seeds and nuts by a hydraulic press. And those are the omega-6s. The modern diet, particularly if you're on a fast food diet, you're getting not only maybe some trans fats, but you're also getting so much omega-6 that you've got maybe 20 times more omega-6 than omega-3 in your system. And if you go out and you look at hunter-gatherers or primitive peoples, the ratio with a natural food diet is more like 4 to 1. And that's probably what you want. You probably want a ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 of less than 4 to 1. And you're only going to do that by taking a lot of omega-3. The Vital trial used very low doses, less than 1,000 milligrams. And I want to point out another study published in the same journal earlier this year used a pharmaceutical, which was essentially EPA, only EPA, but if somebody went and got a patent somehow on this and probably on their production process. Anyway, it's a pharmaceutical. It costs $250 a month. They gave people 4,000 milligrams a day. And what do you know? Heart deaths were reduced by 20%, attacks were reduced by 30%, and strokes by 28%. And there's absolutely no reason that you can't extrapolate, because this was molecularly the same stuff, EPA. There's nothing special about it. It's very clear that if you want to disprove that a natural product works, all you have to do is figure out what the effective dose is and then not give it, and then have a press release and get it published in a major journal. So thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to talk about that at greater length, Eric. And I think you and I are literally on the same page. We're going to go to Sybil in SoCal. And Sybil writes, two supplements I would like to take contain microcrystalline cellulose and citric acid. In the case of citric acid, I find that it is derived from a mold rather than citrus because this is cheaper. What's your opinion about these additives? Are they safe? So I'm going to start with the citric acid, Sybil, because that is the one that is the more controversial. And I have attended numerous lectures by Randy Shoemaker, who's one of the mold toxin mavens of science and alternative medicine. And he is pretty clear that if you are mold sensitive, and I would include for this both people who get sick, who get headaches in a moldy setting, or who get worse, maybe a chronic fatigue type syndrome. These are people, and people with mold allergies. It's probably a good idea to avoid citric acid that is derived from mold. And you can find citrus derived products, but you do need to inquire with the manufacturer because it's the same molecule. The problem is not the molecule. The problem is what's hitching a ride and how good is the purification. And according to Dr. Shoemaker, not good enough when you're talking about a toxin illness. In the case of the microcrystalline cellulose, we fall into that generally recognized as safe, and the only adverse effects that are reported anywhere are gastrointestinal. And that makes sense because this is basically fiber. This is a cellulose compound, and so think of it as a very complex sugar molecule that's all linked together. And when you fracture it, you get little particles that act as a binder and they're basically like sand in a compound. They help distribute all of the active ingredients, keep them blended. And sometimes, you know, you only have a little bit of something and you don't want it to all clump up. So you have to do something to allow it to be distributed and remain distributed. When I looked online, I found pretty reasonable stuff on Wikipedia. I found Medscape had addressed it, drugs.com had addressed it, and I really don't think they're lying. There was a site that was supposedly written by an RN, this post anyway, who said that these were nanoparticles, that they would clog up the cell walls, that they would damage physiology, and I want to emphasize, ain't no evidence for that that I could find anywhere. So if you know of some that's actually published science, please send it to me. But I'm going to come down saying, give you a yellow light, caution on citric acid if you have mold illness. and a green light on the microcrystalline cellulose. Don't take, you know, scads of the stuff because it'll probably throw off your microbiome a little bit, since there are certainly bacteria that can break this stuff down. I mean, after all, the reason termites can eat wood is because the bacteria in their gut can break down cellulose. So I don't think we want termite bacteria in our guts, so we probably don't want to feed it large volumes. That being said, wood can be good. This was just too cool, and it dovetailed with Sibel's question, so we're going to roll with it. This new technology turns wood into Valium. Yeah, you heard me right. So during drug manufacturing, they produce a lot of hazardous waste, mostly flammable solvents, which are used to evaporate things and help create the complex molecules that drugs are based on. Researchers reporting in ACS Central Science at the American Chemical Society's journal report a method to produce pharmacologically relevant compounds in two or three steps with water as the only waste product, using wood chips as starting materials. So it's not just mulch anymore, it's potentially Valium. It breaks down to the lignans, if you'll pardon the pun. Lignans are cross-linked phenolic compounds. These are, in other words, a ring, and they are a set of bonded rings, so that gives wood its strength. And when you make paper from wood, you pull the lignans out because they will turn the paper yellow. And oddly enough, it actually increases the strength of the paper when you do that. Lignans you will have also heard about because there's a doctor who's always saying that don't eat beans because they contain lignans and lignans are bad. And I don't think that's true, although some people do have gastrointestinal issues when they eat lignans. And I think that relates to what I was talking about before. If you got the wrong microbiome, you may have to grow yourself a better one before you can tolerate beans. But these new techniques for depolymerizing lignin break it up into these phenolic compounds. And these are complex shapes that can be used to make pharmaceuticals. And so the old way of manufacturing Valium was multiple steps. It used flammable solvents, and it created about equal amounts of waste and Valium. The new process uses a catalytic method. It basically creates monomers from lignin and turns those into benzodiazepine without producing any waste at all. There might be some new advantages for drugs. And these complex shapes, this is how biology works. The body uses cholesterol. It manufactures cholesterol. It uses cholesterol as the backbone for a bunch of different hormones. Cortisol, testosterone, and all the other steroid hormones that you've heard of. Androstenedione, the doping drugs that keep getting outlawed and people keep getting caught cheating with. These are all basically a cholesterol molecule with a few side groups attached. It's super interesting. Chemistry, particularly biochemistry, was my bete noire and my favorite friend during medical school because it was so beautiful, but it required so much work to understand and memorize that I had a love-hate relationship, as you do with difficult things, right? You often have a love-hate relationship with difficult people. At least I know that myself. So what I'm saying is that biochemistry is cool. You should take a look at those molecules and notice their shapes. You can just look them up on Wikipedia and you'll start seeing the correspondences and understand. And it's really marvelous how this shape can do things in the body. I mean, what is DNA? It's basically kind of little molecules that code for other things to happen. And then those things build big molecules, and the whole cellular apparatus turns into this complex, teeming mass of life on the planet. It's super cool, and it's happening at all orders of magnitude. We are now going to talk about how important mucus is and recent mucus research. I know, right? But here's some fun facts about mucus. The average person produces several liters of mucus every day, and you've only got about 4.5 liters of blood, by the way, so that's like half your blood volume. So between saliva and mucus, you recycle your blood volume every 24 hours. And so just stop and think about it for a moment. Most of that mucus you don't notice except when you've got a cold, but it is lining 200 square meters of our body. This is a crazy number. We have 200 square meters of surface coiled up and crumpled up inside of us. And mucus has always been thought to just be kind of a rinsing thing, you know, lubricant, physical barrier. It's actually not. There are all of these branched sugar molecules called glycans that are found in mucus, and there's hundreds of difference. And again, this is about the shape of the molecule. So they do slide past each other, and that's kind of what we thought they were doing, but they also do something much more important. They form a kind of brush-like structure, like a bottle brush, if you will. And these glycans actually have a profound effect on the ability of bacteria to proliferate and thrive. In particular, this research that I'm about to tell you about was done at MIT, and the chief researcher is, Ribic. I'm not finding her first name, but this is Dr. Ribic, and her work was looking at Pseudomonas, which is one of the most dangerous lung infections. In studying it, she showed that the mucins, the glycans that are there in mucus, actually changed the behavior of the Pseudomonas. They stopped the Pseudomonas from being able to produce toxins, and they couldn't communicate with other bacteria. So they changed the DNA that the bacteria were expressing. It reduced their bacterial proliferation, and they couldn't attach to or kill host cells. So this was like phenomenal stuff just by putting isolated glycans on top of these bacteria. She also worked in patients with burn wounds, and she used mucins and mucin glycans and showed a strong reduction in bacterial proliferation. So this has obvious medical benefits, particularly in an age of increasing antimicrobial resistance. This is essentially altering the epigenetic expression of bacteria. Her work has shown also that glycans block the horizontal gene transfer of resistance information. So this could be a way of preventing resistance that was present in one bacteria in a particular environment of passing to other bacteria and creating polydrug resistance, which is an issue that is becoming more and more significant, incredibly important, and I have a whole Halloween segment coming up dedicated to superbugs and bacterial resistance, because I always try to come up with really scary stuff for the Halloween program. So I want to take just a moment and give you a interesting news of the weird. This was developed at the university. We'll leave you with the shorts that help you walk and run better. This increases somebody actually invented an exosuit. It weighs 5 kilograms, and it has 2 fabrics that wrap around your thigh, and they connect to a waist belt, and there are cables, and they pull on the thigh wrap to help you flex your hip. And there's a little battery pack on these things. So they checked on efficiency on treadmills, and basically it improved your energy use by 9% with walking and 4% with running. And I cannot imagine a more useless device, because, okay, when I'm walking or running, in general, I am doing that to get exercise. So why would I wear a device that reduces my energy and expenditure by 10%? I don't want to make my running more efficient. I want to make my muscles more efficient. Help me out here. I'm sure that cost a lot of money to develop. What on earth is the application for it? And who would want to buy it? Just asking. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast.
please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. Or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.